Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us. This is a personal finance show on money, how it works, how to invest it, and how to live without worrying about it. I'm your host, David Stein. Today is episode 470. It's titled, How the Economy Really Works: Savings, Investing, Consuming, and Market Distortions. In today's episode, I want to go back to the basics, how everything is connected, the important linkages between spending, income, production, investing, and what about hoarding and other market distortions? There are some identities, some relationships that are so key to the economy that we really need to understand them and, frankly, be fascinated by them, how this economic dance works. We can understand the linkages, but we're never sure how businesses will react, how households will react, what the government will do. So let's take this review, look at how everything is connected together. The first identity is that spending in the economy equals income. Every dollar spent in the economy is someone else's income. Our salary, our income that we get from our employer, is an expense of our employer. When our employer buys desks for its employees, that boosts the income of the manufacturer of the desk. That's the first identity. Spending equals income. The second identity is that savings equals income less spending. If we're trying to save personally, we have to spend less than we receive in income. If we're trying to save 10% of our income, then we spend 10% less than what we took in. In the U.S., the personal savings rate last month was 3.8%. That's the amount that households saved as a percent of their disposable income. Disposable income is income after paying taxes. Now, that's personal savings, household savings. Businesses also save. When a business spends less than it receives in revenue in its sales, that savings is called profits. Corporate profits are business savings. The more our employer spends on salaries, the lower its profits or business savings. Now, that brings up sort of a conflict. Spending equals income, but in order to save, we have to spend less than our income. And that means when we save, we're depriving someone else of their income. What happens then if everyone tries to increase their savings at the same time? This is known as the paradox of thrift. It's associated with economist John Maynard Keynes. When a large portion of the population increases their savings, then spending decreases because in order to save, we have to spend less. Businesses then, because they see less demand, produce less. And if businesses are trying to save more, boost their profits, then they'll buy less from other businesses. They may have fewer workers. And so across the economy, overall income falls as households and businesses try to save more because they're spending less and because every dollar spent is someone else's income. If everyone is trying to save more by spending less, then overall income can fall. Katarina Verman wrote about this for the St. Louis Fed. She wrote, "Let's assume I want a new computer, so I start saving an extra $100 each month that I would otherwise spend going out to eat. By choosing not to spend that $100, I deny the waitstaff at my favorite restaurant some work hours and tips. I eat some portion of their income. And as a result, these workers also have to reduce their consumption because they are earning less. If society, as opposed to an individual, follows this saving pattern, this snowball or Keynesian multiplier effect could ultimately lead to decreased consumer spending and lower income for everyone. Lower income means that the economy doesn't grow as fast and it becomes more difficult to save." That's the paradox of thrift. So those are our two first identities. Spending equals income. Every dollar spent is some other entity's or person's income. Second identity, savings equals income less spending. Every dollar saved deprives someone else of income. Now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Sometimes it's just nice to sit back, relax, maybe even take a nap. That's not what you want your money to be doing. You want it to be working hard for you, earning interest, generating returns. That's where the Betterment Automated Investing and Savings app can help. Betterment's technology gives you advanced tools that are built to help you maximize returns. They have diversified portfolios of low-cost ETFs that have been constructed by experts, high-yield cash accounts where your money can earn 11 times the national average, and automated investing technology like automated rebalancing. These tools can help you reach your savings and investing goals. Betterment is a fiduciary. That means it's their job to act in your best interest. They will never recommend an investment or give you guidance unless they believe it will help you reach your financial goals. So visit Betterment.com to get started. Learn more about the high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk, performance not guaranteed, cash reserves offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. What about borrowing money? Where does debt fit? Debt reduces future savings. Or we can put it another way. When we take on debt, we are spending future savings today. If I go out and take out a loan to purchase a car, I get the car today. And that spending flows through the economy. It's income for the car dealership and the car manufacturer. But it accelerates that spending today. Now, in the future, I have to spend less so that I can repay the debt. Debt can increase income, purchasing power, and savings across the economy. The car dealership that sold me the car could save more by taking that revenue that it received from me and not spending it and saving it. When we borrow, we can borrow from someone else, an individual, personal loan. And in that case, they're taking some of their savings and they're giving it to me. Other ways that savings can be allocated to someone else or a business through borrowing is corporate bonds. Corporations will issue debt, a bond that pays an interest rate and has a set maturity. Households and other businesses could purchase that bond, allowing the seller of the bond to raise some capital to spend, such as to build a new factory. So that's borrowing within the economy. There's a special type of borrowing from a bank. And when we borrow from a bank, the bank has a loan receivable and then deposits money in our account that we can then spend. And the act of borrowing increases the amount of money in the economy. It's newly created money. Unlike a corporation issuing a bond and the funding of that bond comes from money that already exists in the economy in the form of savings. When a business borrows from a bank, the bank creates new money. It's an accounting entry. They simply create a deposit, and that deposit is offset by a receivable, a loan receivable on the bank's balance sheet. Because banks can create money as part of their lending activities, and that can increase the money supply, the amount of spending in the economy, that can lead to bubbles due to too much debt issuance. And that debt issuance can certainly be from banks, but also debt issuance from businesses issuing bonds and taking savings from households and businesses and investing them. We saw this in the 1920s. There was something called skyscraper bonds, where bonds were being sold to raise money to build very tall buildings around the U.S. Lee Thomas Smith, president of the National Association of Building Owners and Managers, wrote in 1926, "Buildings are being put up entirely through the endeavor of bond houses to sell bonds, whether the buildings are needed or not. Overproduction, in this case of skyscrapers, is caused by speculators who borrow at full cost of construction, regardless of return. Then they sell the building at a profit and then proceed to erect another one somewhere else." There was a skyscraper bubble, a corporate real estate bubble in the 20s that was funded by debt. The housing bubble in the U.S. in the mid-2000s that was funded by debt, where borrowers were taking on 2-3 mortgages and buying multiple houses that they couldn't afford because the debt was being issued without verifying income. Central banks seek to regulate the amount of borrowing by raising its policy rate. the short-term interest rate, which in the U.S. is over 5% right now. That has led to higher longer-term interest rates and has discouraged some borrowing. It's more difficult to get a mortgage. It's more expensive to get a mortgage. And that can reduce the pace of borrowing, spending, and income growth. Central banks do that in order to make sure that the amount of spending in the economy doesn't exceed the capacity of businesses to produce goods and services. Constrained capacity combined with increased spending power, increased money supply, can lead to inflation. And that's what we've seen the last few years. So far, we've discussed the private sector, households and businesses, how spending equals income, how savings is income less spending, how debt borrowing it takes future savings and allows us to spend it today. And this is domestically. There's also the foreign sector, trade. Businesses buy and sell goods and services with other countries, and governments measure that. A trade surplus is when businesses in a country sell more overseas than businesses and households buy from overseas businesses. There's a trade surplus. More is being sold than is being bought and brought in. A trade deficit is the opposite, where businesses and households purchase a greater monetary value of goods and services from outside the country than businesses sell to households and businesses outside of the country. The impact of a trade surplus is it increases domestic income and potentially savings because businesses have more income because they're selling stuff to the private sector in other countries. And then that income could be saved. A trade deficit does the opposite. It means income is flowing out of the country and potentially savings are being reduced as businesses and households buy a bunch of stuff and services, more than what is being sold to the private sector outside of the country. So we have the domestic sector, but we also have the foreign sector. And then there's the public sector. Now, governments typically don't save. They don't spend less than they receive in tax revenues and fees. That's called a budget surplus. It's rare. Most of the time, governments, the federal government, runs a budget deficit. It spends more than it receives in tax revenue. And that deficit spending allows the private sector to have higher incomes and savings. The federal government buys from businesses. It sends funds to households, such as Social Security payments, food stamps. The government could pay for Medicare. That deficit spending provides income to the private sector. The federal government funds that deficit spending by selling government bonds. Households and businesses that have savings can purchase those bonds and earn interest. But the money that the government spends, the deficit spending, the amount of spending that goes out into the economy above and beyond the tax revenue received, that increases purchasing power across the economy as a whole. Now, there are some distortions when it comes to the public sector, and that distortion is known as quantitative easing. Central banks can purchase government bonds that would have been purchased by the private sector, or maybe were first purchased by the private sector, but the central bank buys those bonds, and they buy them with newly created money. That act of the central bank creating money, purchasing bonds, leads to more money in the economy, a greater money supply. It leads to more income in the economy because the federal government's running a deficit. It's spending more than it receives in income. And that deficit is being funded by central banks. So now we have more money, more income, greater net worth going out into the private sector economy. So those are all the sectors. We have the private sector, we have the foreign sector, we have the public sector, the banking sector. We have money flowing through, money being created by banks, money created by the Federal Reserve and other central banks. We have income being received. We have households and businesses not spending some of that income to save it. Much of the income is spent. Every dollar spent equals someone else's income. Every dollar saved deprives someone or some business of income. Can borrow money and take future savings and spend it today. That's the flow of funds. But the whole point, is to be able to buy what we need and want. And for that, we need businesses to produce what we need and want. We have the flow of money, but we also have the flow of goods and services. And businesses are never quite sure what and how much to produce. And that's why I think of it as this giant dance as businesses try to figure out, well, what do we make? How much do we make? And consumers are trying to figure out, well, what do I want to spend money on? Do I want to borrow money in order to spend it? How much do I want to save? How much income do I think I'll get this year? Before we continue, let me pause and share some words from this week's sponsors. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. I know in our business, having the right candidates for the job is critical to keep our business running smoothly. Now, LinkedIn isn't just another job board. LinkedIn has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. It gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. LinkedIn does all that while making the process easy and intuitive. Hiring is easy when you have that many quality candidates. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. So post your job for free at linkedin.com/David. That's linkedin.com/David to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. For businesses to make things and provide goods and services, they need resources to produce them. Primary resources, labor. They need employees to produce the goods and services. Sometimes they need natural resources to produce the goods and services. But they often need capital. Capital are tools, machinery, buildings, and technology that are used to make things and to provide services. And that capital comes from investors, from savers. We've mentioned how corporations can issue bonds, debt, and they sell that debt to the private sector, to households, and to other businesses to raise capital to then use to purchase tools, machinery, buildings, new technology so they can produce more and better things and do it more efficiently, become more productive so that they can earn more income per item produced. Businesses can also sell equity capital. They can sell a portion of the enterprise. It could be a public enterprise. It could be a private enterprise. But they can sell an equity stake in the company. Or they could sell an equity stake in a commercial building, for example, that be a commercial real estate operator that wants to buy a building. And so they borrow some of the money and then they raise some equity capital to purchase the building. And then those rents, portion of those rents, are used to pay the service, the debt, and also cover expenses of the building, but also a portion could go as dividends to the equity holders. Once debt capital and equity capital are raised, securities are issued, those securities can trade in the secondary market for common stocks. They trade on a stock exchange. Most of the activity when it comes to the financial markets is not providing capital directly to businesses, either debt capital or equity capital. That's done once for a given security or a given fundraising. And then those securities are bought and sold over and over again in the secondary market. And the holders of those securities, the debt securities, the bonds, receive interest payments. And the holder of the equity securities, the stocks, will often receive a portion of the profit in dividends or will hopefully receive the profits going forward. Much of our investing is not done directly. It's done through an indirect investment vehicle, such as a mutual fund or ETF. So those are all the pieces. We have what's going on the flow of funds side, the income, the savings, the consuming, the borrowing. And then we have the production side, the businesses deciding what to produce, producing them. And then we have the crossover. We have the investment by the private sector so that the businesses can raise capital to produce more and better goods without anyone really knowing exactly what the demand will be for what is being produced. There are some other distortions. One is hoarding. Hoarding means to hide something away for a future productive use. Maybe it's food that we're going to store and use later. Maybe it's fabric to make something. A lot of very wealthy people like to purchase land, like land that's not being farmed, just land that's hoarded away. Ammunition could be hoarded. Now, hoarding isn't necessarily bad, but it's a distortion because if everyone hoards, then capital becomes scarce for businesses. It becomes more difficult to issue debt, bonds, or to raise equity capital because savings are being put into things that are hoarded. Gold, for example. Gold is something that has no productive use other than for jewelry. If the private sector decides that they want to own gold and that's the most exciting thing, then the price of gold could skyrocket. But then the rest of the economy could be starved for capital because everyone wants to hold gold or Bitcoin. There is no productive use for Bitcoin other than as a form of digital gold. It can be used for payments, but it's not terribly efficient. There's a huge energy drain to maintain the Bitcoin network, and I own Bitcoin. I own gold. I have some hoarding that I do, but it's not the primary way that I direct my savings. Most of my savings is in investments. Investments are an allocation of savings to areas that have a positive expected return. They generally have some cash flow element to it. And they're used, that capital is used in the productive economy. If we're funding something directly, an initial public offering for a common stock or a bond issuance, much of the investing is in the secondary market. But that secondary market trading needs to be there so that companies are able to issue capital. Nobody would buy an initial public offering of common stock if it immediately fell in price because there was no secondary trading, no way to get out of it, no way to see the value of the investment increase as profits increase. And having that secondary market set the consensus price of the securities is incredibly important. Even if that secondary market trading doesn't send more capital to the business, it's an integral part of this entire system. But a potential distortion is if the private sector doesn't want to invest in helping businesses raise or maintain their capital base. If instead it's going to hoarding where there isn't a productive use. And hoarding isn't necessarily bad, it just you can't have too much of it. Another distortion is rents. Not rent of a building, but rents, the economic term, meaning an artificial profit that shouldn't exist in a fair competitive market. To quote by Gerrit de Geest, he's a Belgian legal scholar. He writes, rents are, in its essence, the distributional side effects of market distortions. They are the extra income that some people receive because of market distortions. They make some people wealthier, those who receive them, the rents, and others poorer, those who pay for goods and services, whose prices, due to the market distortion, due to the rents, are too high. An example of a market distortion was back in the mid-1920s, where General Electric in the U.S., Philips in the Netherlands, the German company Osram and others met and they formed the Phoebus cartel. And they set quotas on how many light bulbs they would each produce. And they set standards for those light bulbs because light bulbs were getting better and better. They were lasting longer and they reduced the standard that a light bulb, an incandescent light bulb, could last 1,000 hours. And the reason why they were doing it is because the businesses were producing more and more light bulbs and the market was being flooded. And then if the light bulbs were getting better and lasting longer, they were worried that they were impacting the price. And so they formed a cartel and they introduced planned obsolescence. that the light bulbs could only last so much time. And as a result, their profits ballooned. They earned rents, artificial profits, because of their collusion. One of the roles of government is to decide when these rents or artificial profits are occurring due to lack of fair competition. In the U.S., the Federal Trade Commission last month sued to block the proposed supermarket merger between Kroger and Albertsons. The FTC said that a merger would eliminate competition between Kroger and Albertsons, and that would lead to higher prices. And not only would it lead to higher prices, but it would contribute to lower quality products and services. Now, that's the FTC's view. That's their role, and there'll be a court case, and Kroger and Albertsons will argue that it won't reduce competition because of Walmart and Target and Amazon also selling groceries. But that's a distortion. We have hoarding as a distortion. We have artificially high profits as a distortion. Planned obsolescence is a distortion. The whole idea things could only last so long or deliberately break so businesses can produce more and individuals have to consume more. Now, it's not always straightforward. There was an article recently in the Wall Street Journal about how kitchen appliances are getting more complicated and breaking more often. American households spent 43% more on home appliances in 2023 than they did in 2013. On an inflation-adjusted price, so backing out inflation, average cost of a home appliance went from $390 to $558. And they're breaking more frequently because they're becoming more complex. Some of that complexity was introduced as part of energy savings mandates from the government, but they also have more computer chips. And the reality is many of the parts are cheaper, more fragile. And so between some more fragile parts, greater complexity, they're breaking more and they're not lasting as long. Now, is that planned obsolescence or is there something else going on? That's for the FTC and other regulators to determine. But one appliance technician says, in the majority of cases, I would say buying a new appliance makes more economic sense than repairing it because the cost of repair is skyrocketing because the equipment is more complex. So we have this amazing economic dance between consumers and producers. We have all these linkages as households and businesses decide how much they want to spend and what did they want to spend it on? How much do they want to save? Businesses deciding what they want to produce and how much? Private sector deciding how much they want to invest and help other businesses raise capital to build out production capacity, or how much do they want to hoard? We have the government deciding how much it wants to spend on infrastructure that facilitates transportation and eases the ability of business to ship products and to produce things. How much do they want to spend on education so we have an educated workforce to help businesses? Governments have to decide how active they want to be to prevent and cure distortions that occur. And then ultimately, as consumers, we have to decide what market signals we want to send by what we buy and how much we buy and how much we invest versus hoard. It's this dance, linkages, that keeps me doing the podcast, trying to understand and just watching things evolve and going through the process weekly of explaining what's happening. But sometimes it's just good to step back and to see how it all fits together. And that's what we tried to do in this episode, episode 470. Thanks for listening. You may be missing some of the best Money for the Rest of Us content. Our weekly Insider's Guide email newsletter goes beyond what we cover in our podcast episodes and helps elevate your investment journey with information that works best in written and visual formats. With the Insider's Guide, you can discover actionable investing insights provided only to our newsletter subscribers. Unlock greater investing confidence with high-value snippets from our premium products, plus membership and Asset Camp. Access exclusive news, offers, and events you won't hear about anywhere else. Further connect with the Money for the Rest of Us team and community. And when you sign up, we'll also send you our exclusive investing checklist to help you invest with more confidence right away. The Insider's Guide is the best next step to get the most out of your investment journey. If you're not on the list, go to moneyfortherestofus.com and subscribe with the Become a Better Investor sign-up box. Everything I've shared with you in this episode has been for general education. I've not considered your specific risk situation. I've not provided investment advice. This is simply general education on money, investing in the economy. Have a great week.